Hi, I'm Brandon Webb, former Navy SEAL and New York Times bestselling author. If you're like me, you want real security and defense news you can trust. You're probably tired of hearing the same talking heads, guys who have never seen the front lines, saying the same BS 100 different ways. It's why I founded SoftRep.com, military-grade news produced entirely by our staff of military veteran journalists. Sign up at SoftRep for real news, real experience, real experts. SoftRep does what the mainstream media can't, deliver authentic content straight from the front lines. Sign up for a free trial membership today, and I'll give you my best-selling ebook, The Red Circle, for free. But that's not all. Your SoftRep membership also includes access to cutting-edge defense and security news by military experts, access to our award-winning documentaries, ebooks, special member events, and much more. So what are you waiting for? Let us know you're in. Sign up for your free trial membership today. Join our community at SoftRep. That's SoftRep.com.
Brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to SoftRep Radio. Special operations military news and straight talk with the guys in the community.
This episode, managing editor Stavros Atlamazoglou and former Delta Force operator and software writer George Hunt sit down with Sensei James Williams. Sensei Williams trains America's most elite special operations units in combatives and knife fighting. During their discussion, they talk about knife making, combatives, and the right mental state for combat, among other things. They also go over some amazing stories from down raids and how Sensei's combative teaching has saved the lives of America's best. Can you please go over your time in the military?
Kalimera Stavros. I was in the military from 66 to 69. Started out as 11 Bravo. I did end up going to officer candidate school because I couldn't do what I wanted because I couldn't see. But it was a good, interesting time for me. Taught me a lot of things besides that special sense of humor we discussed that have helped me throughout my life and helped me later on here to be able to help our modern military, modern, because it's actually quite a different military from the 60s to now. Help me understand in designing tools and stuff for them and training them, how I can benefit them better, and gave me a lot of motivation as well to help. I buried a lot of guys in 68 through Big Tet, and you see survivor assistance, initial notification of death. You see the consequence of that over and over and over again. I was in a little base. We had that. It was a 90-degree duty that I had for 9 months. And I finally had to go to JAG and just say, I can't do this anymore. The workload was intense. And it's interesting because I can't remember most of it. I remember specific things. I don't even remember how many people I buried, but somewhere probably 70 to 100 or more. So it really lets you know. I mean, the warrior's gone. He's done. He's dead. But the people that are left, the cost to them goes their entire lives. It changes their lives. And so you recognize that any help that can be given, in fact, I just had a long conversation with a gentleman that got a hold of me who I had trained, who was special operations, one of those special guys, and wanted to thank me because stuff that I'd taught him saved his life several times downrange. He was saying, well, you know, thanks doesn't seem like enough. And I said, there's nothing better I could have than just knowing that you are safe because of that and you got home. in something besides a flag draped coffin. Mm-hmm. So all of this teaching, designing tools, etc., is very personal for me. It's not an ego thing about do my knives look cooler or anything like that. It's, are they going to work in the most extreme of situations when life and death is on the line? So my original knife, the Hisatsu, was designing that. I went back and looked at Japanese history because I have a long background in martial arts that started. I don't count going to Catholic school with the Irish in the 50s, but I learned a lot there. But I've been in martial arts for 60 plus years of almost every kind. And the last 40 has been concentrated more into classical samurai Kodyu, which means like old method or old way. The vast majority of what we call martial arts are not martial in the classical sense of the term. Mars was the god of war. War is about killing people and breaking shit. It's done with tools. Art's ability to do it to your opponent without doing it back to you. And when you don't do the art of it, the battle of the Somme, Pickett's charge up some, I mean, we could go on and on and on, right? When you don't do that, there's no art in it. There's just freaking carnage. So when you have back and forth exchanges of force, MMA and karate, not that these things are bad, by the way, I did almost all of this stuff and I learned a lot from it. We just need to understand if you're studying something, what was it designed for? JJ, which is basically Japanese judo, Neiwaza Katamiwaza from Japanese judo, is a really fun sport. I had my boys do it. I've still one son that's still involved. I have my grandchildren doing it. It's a nice base, but it's the root of a tree, never designed for war and really not well adapted to street stuff or anything else. When you're looking at the arts that were used for war, they're completely different, so much different that it's hard to describe in a sense. It's easier to feel. No contesting for space. In our sword system, we don't even have blocks. We don't block punches. We don't block swords. We don't block all kinds of things. There's a Kodyu concept called Kobu Itai, and it means attack and defense as a single motion. And there's several of these fundamental principles. And one of the foundations of all of this is deception and not fakes or feints, because those don't have integrity. They can be perceived easily. But literally methods of moving and stuff that you could tell a person what you would do. And yet when you move and they have to go to deep programming, they can't see it. And the human mind is programmed a particular way so that no conscious thought is needed to like walk or stand up or go up and down stairs or do all kinds of things. We'd be overwhelmed if our conscious mind had to do that. And so you're literally going in and reprogramming, which was interesting to me because I had to give up something that I'd worked really, really hard for. I'd spent a huge part of my life getting on top of an alpha male food chain and my kickboxing and stuff in the 70s. And we actually could do takedowns and stuff. It was a little bit different. I was trained much differently than the full contract karate stuff at the time. And I actually had to give up that programming in order to do this programming, which is interesting. But when you look at the very, very best that we have, they don't contest for space hardly ever. It's interesting how some of them have come to those same basic programming mechanisms in a sense. Not all of them, but some who have. You know, I'm always interested because I'm working with these guys, they're going downrange. In the last, 19 years, we've had people who've had more experience in combat by orders of magnitude than we've ever had before, ever. There's a huge wealth of knowledge there. I'm not optimistic that it's going to go up the food chain. However, I'm trying to learn as much as I can from them as what I'm teaching, because it's a two-way street and you need to stay a student. You're constantly learning. So when it came time to design a knife, the single most important thing for a small knife, and I define small as if it can't lop off a limb, it's a small knife, is penetration. And so when I was looking at a lot of designs out there, recognizing that, well, you're not going to get penetration out of that, and not just penetration of soft parts of the human body, but what are people wearing? Heavy wool and cotton clothing in a lot of these countries. maybe military style vest where you have to punch through nylon and everything as well, and then bones and then whatever you have, because you don't always get a perfect choice with these things. So I looked back in history and found a style called Osoraku Zukuri. I was looking at, what do we need most? So penetration is critical. And when you look at a lot of shapes and you test them out, you find that they're not very effective at this, except under maybe some ideal conditions, but a lot of them are not very effective at all. So I knew I needed that. And that shape was just perfect. It was made famous by the mid 16th century daimyo or warlord Takeda Shingen. And so I looked at that, and not only did it have tremendous penetration because it's got a very extended point, but it also had the ability to slash really well, which is secondary, but still, it's not that it's not important because of the shape of the blade and the arc that an arm makes when you're slashing. And so the two went together so well, shouldn't surprise anybody because that was a sword culture for a really long period of time up into actually the modern era when Admiral Perry's ships, you know, went into Tokyo Bay in the 1850s. It was still a feudal society. So I looked at that. I looked at handle shape to be a neutral handle because how are you going to hold the knife? Well, I don't know yet. People say, well, what are you going to do if this or that happens? I go, oh, I don't know. And they're like, well, you're supposed to be the expert. I said, well, I don't want to know. I'm listening to the problem, right? Every problem in the universe has inherent in the problem the solution. When I bring my style, my anger, my aggression, my subjectivity to the fight, I'm not looking at clearly at what's actually happening. And there's a couple of concepts in Kodo. One is called Mushin, which means no mind, but it means like no thinking conscious mind. Uh-huh. So that includes your fears, your biases, your political shit, all of that subjective crap has got to be gone here. And another aspect is Mizu no Kokoro. Mizu means water, and Kokoro is like, it's not quite soul in a sense, but it's like mind, spirit, essence. And if you think about water, if it's ruffled by wind or dropping a pebble in it, and you look in it, you can't clearly, it doesn't clearly reflect. If it's absolutely calm, it clearly reflects. So you want a mind like a mirror. I want to remove myself from the equation. I want all the information about what's happening to come into me unbiased, objective as it can be. And then the solution is going to be apparent in that problem. And all I have to do is implement the solution. So getting jacked up and all of this stuff before a fight is a fear-based mechanism. It doesn't make you run and scared, but it makes you very subjective in the process. And it's not the highest level of human function. And another aspect is no normal physical strength, no contractile muscle strength, which is very counterintuitive, but it's primarily counterintuitive because our normal outlook is fear-based. And again, I go back to being very successful. I'd climb my way to the top of an alpha male food chain, which eventually, as I looked around, I realized I don't even like half of these people. I mean, we had Hell's Angels. We had guys out of prison. We had some hard guys. And I'm like, man, I don't even like most of these people. What am I doing here, right? This is a complete 180 degrees from what made me successful there. If success could actually be, you know, beating people up, is that success? I'm not sure. I had to scratch the itch, but I don't know if that would call that success or not, right? And I was telling you earlier, Stavros, I can count the number of teeth I had to replace and the couple that I haven't, but I don't know how many brain cells I lost in the process.
How do you achieve these conditions? So there's no mind and no muscle involved.
So I'm going to define a few words how we define them in Namagyu. So normal is a fear-based construct. And that's how 99%+ of the population makes their decisions based on normal, because that's the only paradigm they have. Now, some of those fears are rational fears, but a huge number of those fears, as we can see from the current, you know, insanity, are subjective inner fears that cause reactions in people. They're not acting, they're reacting. And they get played by that. They get played by politicians. They get played for the press, which has nothing to do with news and information or nothing to do with information. So you have to actually have a methodology for training for what we call normal, which in our words, this means faith-based. And I'm not talking about religious. Those are belief systems. That's a different thing. So hence, you know, the need to define words when we talk about them. And simple things like we depend on gravity for everything, but nobody thinks about it and worries about it. Oxygen transfer is the single most important thing that happens in an individual to keep them alive. But I haven't found anybody yet that lays awake in the middle of the night wondering, if I take the next breath, is oxygen transfer going to take place? So talk about that. That would be pretty weird. So
that's one of my chief fears, honestly. No.
Yes. And so when I talk about faith, that's what we're talking about. What you find is, what I find personally is, the less that James does, the better the solutions come. And that includes solutions that may be what people would call violent solutions. And literally learning how to access your physiology differently. Like, I'll sit and face somebody and I'll move my right scapula up, but you can't see any motion in me because only one muscle, the levator scapula, moves that. And if you can isolate it, it'll pull the scapula up and somebody behind me can feel it, or pull them into the center by flexing the rhomboids minor and major. You know, actually starting to go in and turn off all of the unnecessary muscle flexions that come from the fight flight. I had an interesting couple of discussions with Dr. Dan Siegel a few years ago at Esalen Institute in Big Sur. He's one of the leading neuroscientists, really a really interesting guy. And at one point, we were walking back to lunch from the lecture hall. And I said, you know, doc, your survival instinct will get you killed. And he goes, well, it's there for a reason. I go, yeah, survival of the species, not for survival of the individual, right? And you can see this in Africa. It's really easy to watch the herd instinct. It's for survival of the species. The individual is sacrificed in the process. Okay, well, if we're going to be more than that, then you have to take responsibility. There's a big word. For everything, your gender, your height, whether you had good eyes or bad eyes, your age, all kinds, you have to take personal responsibility for everything in your life if you're going to be able to develop and actually change that fundamental programming. And so there's a method for that, and the old Kodi was a method for that. It's mostly gone, and I would say even in Japan, I don't know how much of this exists anymore. Their society is radically changed. You need some violence, I think, too, right? Because it's the things that sense. Can you do this in extremis, or is it something you end up doing in the dojo with a bunch of people that cooperate with you? The great thing is, because I travel and teach a lot, there's always at least one or two people that have a vested interest in my failure when I'm demonstrating techniques or doing this. So I get to go out against people in that sense of the term. Now, I've had other situations as well, but still, I'm in my 70s and I still work with the very best that we have. And I have to make this work on them, even when they're contesting with me and trying not to have it work, because we both need to know, is this going to work better or not? Yeah. Because if it's not, I'm going to sit down and shut the fuck up. There's much at stake. Right on. For this, right? The worst thing that could be is somebody coming back, yeah, that shit you taught us, sir, got a couple of our guys killed. Fuck, right? I can't have that. So I'm very careful with, I have to know it works better. I had a situation a few years ago with a group that wanted to do scenario training. We went out to another part of the range, and they had an SUV, and they were showing me, you know, this is scenario. It's Beirut. Middle of the street, middle of the day. We're blocking the guy in front to back, two guys out on the driver's side, one guy on the passenger side to keep from getting a weapon. You know, we'll breach the window with a couple of rounds of nine if we need to. It's taken us about 90 seconds to get the guy out of the car. We're getting scratched up and cut up a little bit on the glass. In environments like that, people are starting to collapse on us after about 45 or 50 seconds, which complicates the problem. And they asked me, well, how would you do that? So I got the guy out of the car by myself in 15 seconds. The reason is the solution orientation and how I look at those things is really different. The great thing about that group is they're enormously fast learners. A few years later, we had another group in. I'm not going to mention their name, and it was taking them even longer because they were dominating the situation by striking the guy first and all of this. And they end up with a big fight, and it took them 2 minutes to get him out. And I took a couple of these people from the group aside and spent 10 minutes showing them how to do it. In 17 seconds, they had the guy out of the car. It's just a completely different way of looking at solutions where fighting doesn't come into play. Fighting, by definition, is an inefficient solution to problems. And I always ask guys, you know, especially married guys, so how many guys are married? Hands go up. I said, how well does fighting work at home? Doesn't work at all, right? Even if your opponent, like my former wife, is literally half your size, right? I mean, half your weight and a foot shorter, it still doesn't work. Why would we look at that as a solution to problems, right? Because it doesn't work, right? It creates more problems. So this is something that virtually has to be felt. I have to demonstrate. I've got plenty of videos up on my System of Strategy YouTube channel and stuff. However, what you see and what I'm doing are not the same things. It's designed so that you actually can't see it. It's designed to look like something that you already have a paradigm for, you're already programmed for, and it's not that. When I used to go down to Naval Special Warfare, San Diego, and work with TRADET, the most common thing I'd hear is, well, sir, you're so fast. And I go, well, it's not that I'm fast. I'm not doing very much. So if I could start at the 45-meter line and Usain Bolt started at 100 meters, I'd still have a shot at winning. If I started at 60 meters, probably not, right? So if I do a lot less, it takes less time, and it seems like it's faster, but it's just that I'm not doing very much. And then what you're seeing and what I'm doing are not the same things. So when you move and all of a sudden you have a knife at your throat, it seems like it happened almost instantaneously. That, of course, doesn't help them a lot other than the fact that they can know that I do it. But I'm trying to take them down a path that as they continue to look at it, they can start taking less time and being less obvious, shall we say. And since you asked, Stavros, I look at this as, because you're trying to make an analogy so people can have a way of taking a look at this. Tens of millennia ago, our ancestors saw a log floating on a lake, and they pushed on it, had positive buoyancy. And when they laid on it, it held them up, and you could put your spear in your atlatl and paddle across the lake instead of walking around it. You could kill something, put it on, and come back, okay? You know, you come all the way into the modern, and when my brother was living in Pacific Beach, he had a 20-foot Hawaiian racing canoe that weighed like 30 pounds because it's carbon fiber and Kevlar. I could put that thing on my shoulder and walk 2 blocks to the beach and get in, and I mean, enormously more access, much faster than the log and the hand paddle. But you're still accessing the universe law the same way. It still is determined by my physicality, my strength, how much food and water I can take in for how long, and all of that. Also, who knows how long ago, somebody felt this really strong wind. I always say maybe in northern Scotland where you can lean into the wind at like 50 degrees and it holds you up. And they held up an animal skin and they sat on that log, and all of a sudden the log moved without them doing anything. Physical effort. And so like sailing is the process of recognizing an invisible force by its effects and shaping the boat and the sail and the point of sail in accordance with that. And the better you can do that, the more, you know, the more you get from it, the better boat speed, the better everything. If you see a lift, the water's darkling in a bit, you can see a lift, you know, it's going to change. You can prepare for that. You don't see the wind ever. So what I'm starting with is kinetic energy without muscle flexion. I mean, I weigh 215 pounds, 6'2", well, not quite 6'2", but I'm still as tall as I was when I was 30, which is a whole nother thing altogether. And so I have an enormous amount of potential energy. And as soon as I move, it manifests itself. And one of the things I'll do is I'll take one of my 10 kilogram, 22 pound club bells. And I'll put it outside. I'll put it on, you know, like maybe a board or something underneath it. I'll drop that. And I mean, the amount of energy when that hits the ground is enormous. And yet I can let go of it and touch the ground faster than it gets there. Well, I weigh more than 22 pounds and I can move faster than that thing can move. How come I can't take that energy and transfer it? Muscle tension gets in the way. Relaxation allows that energy to move through your body and you're not getting in the way of it. Right?
How do you manage to stay relaxed in a high-stress situation, though?
Training.
Do you have it?
Training. Yeah.
So, yeah. So yeah, it's exactly that. It's training, right? And so that's again why I like to talk to some of those guys and find out what's going on with them. And I have to be careful with this. So I was just back for a ceremony for an award. One of the guys I've known well for a long time stayed at his house and stuff. And a situation took place downrange, and he breached a gate coming through. Three guys, AKs up on him. And he said, "Yes, sir, I knew I was dead," right? But it didn't matter. So in less than 3 seconds, he fired 24 rounds, 8 rounds per guy. All the rounds hit, including a slight hesitation because a guy slid behind some, one of the guys slid behind some women and children. You can't do that with your conscious mind. And what he'd forgotten to tell me, or hadn't taught me because of his own personal character and humility, is he'd been fragged twice outside the gate before that and had to sit down not too long thereafter. And when the guy that was telling the story said, he said, "Yeah, I'm feeling faint." And the guy who was telling the story at the ceremony goes, "Well, you're probably dehydrated." And he goes, "No, I think it's loss of blood," right?
Oh, so damn.
When I first met him, he couldn't even train with us because he was still recovering, right? That's the type of thing, in a sense. You can't think that. He says, "Yes, sir, I can still tell you where every round hit." You can't consciously think that. So you train to let go into a state, right? And you have to be able to do that if you're going to work at the highest level. So some quotes from history. One is, "Fear makes men forget, and skill, which cannot fight, is useless." Brasidas of Sparta. You know their, how their training went way. You know, from the classical samurai, you know, the way of the warrior is resolute acceptance of death. So you accept the situation. You can't be thinking of the fears, and you can't be all of those things. You just accept this is the deal. Just like if you're sailing in a storm, is fear going to help you? The ocean is a scary place. I spent a lot of time in the ocean. It can be a really scary place. And all you can do under those circumstances is get out of yourself and get connected to what's happening. Feel that boat. Trim those sails. Look at the point of sail. What's happening? How's the wind doing? You know, what's the ocean like? I mean, how steep are the waves? Don't be a landlubber and get close to shore. You see that thing from 13th Warrior, well, where they're in the storm. That was actually one of the better parts. The guy that was playing the Arab, Antonio Barreras, Banderas, goes, "Shouldn't we be closer to land?" And the Viking laughs and goes, "This is no day to be close to land, boy." You have to know that you want deep water in a storm. The deeper, the better. Because shallow water changes the shape of the waves on the surface. It makes them closer together and steeper. So you have to know that and relax into those things. So people do this in other ways as well. Okay. It's just more difficult when you're in a situation of life and death, but that's what you train for at the highest level. So in the old ways, that's what you're training for. One of the things I'll do when I'm with a new group is, I'll take an 8.5-11 piece of paper and I'll hold it up, and I take one of my swords and I cut it just whispers through the paper. And I look out and I go, who's tough? I never get anybody saying they're tough. They recognize the sword's going to go right through you. And then I point at the edge and I go, veritas est. This is the truth. If you're going to study a martial art in a classical sense, you first have to define the tool and the situation. Toughness doesn't help here, right? You're not tough enough to take bullets or bombs or all the other things in a combat zone that are bad for you. You can be persevering, right? You can be determined. Toughness is not one of those things when it comes to that, because the human body just isn't that tough. So now we're training for the environment by thinking, okay, I'm not going to be able to take a sword cut and survive. The chances are, how do I get through this? I tell people when people say they're teaching knife courses, well, expect to get cut in a knife fight. I go, well, do you expect to get cut in a gunfight? I mean, people get shot in gunfights, but do you go into it expecting to get shot? I said, is that how you would train, expect to get shot? No, you don't train like that. Why would you do that with a knife? If you're fighting with a knife, like some of these guys I'm seeing back and forth, you could be killing each other and not know it. Speaking from personal experience, you probably won't even know you're cut most of the time in a fight with a knife. And I'm not, so some of this I learned from being really stupid and for some reason surviving it. So why would you do that? You could actually be mortally wounded still in the fight, but not know it yet. That's really bad, right?
Yeah. It's scourging is what it is.
So when you take a look at from their perspective, and another thing that was looked at is Otonashi no Kachi. And that basically means silent victory, no touching of swords, no clashing of blades, which goes with the Kobo Itai, attack and defense as a single movement, not a block and a counter and stuff that's taught in so many of these things. So this was fundamental to really high level Koryu, which was not most of what people learned. Everybody's skill level was higher because you had to be just for survival. But again, it's like being a faster paddler because you train all the time. That's still not being a sailor in that sense of the term.
How sustainable is that mentality, though? The mentality of going to war without any regard for your physical safety?
I'm saying there's acceptance of the environment you're in. It's just acceptance. It's not that you don't do all the smart things. You should have trained these things in already, right? Like I shoot right-handed, left-handed, right eye, left eye, because I don't want to go a right-handed corner with the gun in my left hand or vice versa and using the other, you know. So my eyes don't like that, but I work every day to make sure if I pick a pistol up in my left hand, it comes to my left eye. If I pick it up in my right hand, it comes to my right eye. So you train these things over and over. This is what you do so that in the moment, you've already done all the stuff that you can do about the life and death part. And Paul Howe's a personal friend, told me years ago, the best Delta operator I ever knew was killed by an unsighted AK in the Battle of the Black Sea in Somalia, right? Once you get in a position where you get dragged behind the curve, which is basically what happened there, they couldn't stay that step ahead because of lots of factors, right? Well, now there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, stuff comes out. That's what happens, right? The whole Viking, your fate is what it is. So, and that was another way of recognizing that just you have to let go of the fear of life and death in the moment. Is it possible? Absolutely. But you can't have that in your head. If you have that in your head, you can't function properly. So you train for that. That's what you train for.
Hey, Sensei and Stavros, I think I have a real dumbed down version of the philosophy that you're talking about right now. And the example comes from, I think a lot of people can relate to it, but from the series Band of Brothers, there was a scene where I think the guy was, Lieutenant Spear was talking to, Private Blythe. Now when Private Blythe was asking him, he's like, how do you cope? How do you handle it? How do you handle your fear? How do you get through this situation? And Spear said, hey, Blythe, if you can just accept the fact that you're already dead, everything will be just fine.
And this was a thing that has been echoed throughout ancient warrior cultures is acceptance of death.
Yeah.
This is the deal. I mean, every person needs that to a point because none of us know, right? It could be anything. You just don't know. I mean, you could be doing the most dangerous job and get killed walking across the street or have a drunk driver jump the curb or any number of things. So it's not that you don't recognize the danger. I mean, listen, as my son, the doctor says, he says, life is a sexually transmitted, uniformly fatal disease. We're all going to die here. What you want is die the best way you can for the warrior, especially, but for any person, die the best way you can. Die in service to others. Die doing something, that's helping somebody else. Once you start contracting into your own fears, well, a few years ago in California, woman recognized that I was concealed carry and she was freaking out. That makes me so afraid. What are you so afraid of having to carry that? And I go, what I'm afraid of is I'm afraid that something could happen and I might not be able to help. I said, what you're afraid of is you're afraid of being afraid. That's a whole different thing. I'm carrying a tool because I have the experience, the training, and the willingness, like the gentleman in the prime of his life in that church in Texas, to solve a problem if it comes about and problems come. I just traveled back and through Europe. Every single European airport, I got pulled aside for my bag. I'm just like, yep, that's me. So because I've got tourniquets and hemostats and chest seals and, I carry stuff with me, right? Because you never know. And Gio, you know this absolutely as well. You never know when stuff like this is going to happen. The only thing you can be sure of it is the day you're not prepared, that's when the shit goes down. Yeah. It's just, I mean, it's like universe law, right? So what do? You're prepared all the time. So I didn't get anything taken. I was able to explain to people over time, you know, what's this, what's that, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, are you a medic or a doctor? I go, no, but I've had some training and I know how to use what I have to be able to help somebody if something happened, right? So this is just what you do for your daily life. And that briefcase goes with me everywhere, right? It goes with me in my car. I have, of course, more medical stuff in my car. But that briefcase goes with me everywhere. And I've got lots of things, including a life straw, which I saw SoftRep was putting up. Carry a life straw. I carry a life straw with me everywhere. Because if you've been in some of these places, you know that that water will put you down as fast as almost anything. And it's a miserable experience. So I carry a life straw.
Yeah. And, you know, Sensei, I follow that philosophy. Okay, I'm a photographer. You know, I'm a big-time shooter. And I always have a camera when I leave the house. I just never leave it behind. And people ask me, you know, why I carry it so often. And I say, hey, you know, the day I leave my camera at home is the day I'm going to see a unicorn.
Oh, I know. It'll be the best one moment of shot that'll never repeat itself. And it's a pain in the butt to carry the camera all the time. However, so what, right?
Right, you're right. So what is right?
Yeah. So what? So it's a pain in the butt. So what? People think it's a story. Does it make you feel? I said, no, actually, it's a pain in the butt every day, right?
Hey, Sensei, we know that you design blades, okay? You're not necessarily a Messerschmitt by hand, but you design blades. And who is it that comes to you asking for a specific blade design? I mean, or do they just tell you what they do and you design a blade for them? Or how does that actually work, man?
Yes, generally, yes. The Hisatsu was because of an article I wrote, The Truth About Tanto, in the 90s, because we're seeing points and stuff like the American Tanto point didn't exist in Japan. It doesn't penetrate well. It separates a small cutting edge. It does all kinds of stuff. So when I'm looking at there, I was looking at blade shape. I actually got some flack for the article. And I thought, you know, in my meal speak here, I'm like, fuck you. I buried a lot of guys. I've got sons. What would I want them to carry? What can an 0311, 11 Bravo, what can they carry? Right? Because it can't be a $300 or $400 knife for those guys. They can't carry that kind of stuff. And they don't need it, right? You don't need super steel. So that's where I started looking and came up with this Satsu. And then it worked from there. And then I got a request out of SOCOM for a deep concealment folder. And that became the Otanashi. It had some guidelines. And that knife has probably been in more people downrange than any other knife, almost period. Because it would actually do that Otanashi, which is a 4.5-inch folder in that Osoraku Zukuri design. And then, you know, I made a smaller version of that. And then I've had some other very specific requests out of units for particular knives. Most of the time they trust me with, you know, this is what we're going to use. This is why. So the Williams blade design started with that from requests, specific requests. And I try to match it to the task at hand, like we just did a double-edged dagger. I'm not a huge double-edged dagger fan, actually. I like a single edge for lots of reasons. However, this group needed what they needed. So, you know, I spent a lot of time working on what all do you need if you have two parallel of edges that won't cut very well. And it's not that you're going to slash with it so much, but there's entry points where you want the blade a little bit of angle will facilitate sliding through there to get maximum tissue deformity to facilitate hemorrhaging. That's a kind way of cutting the shit out of people.
Right on.
So, you know, I took a look into history and handles. Guards and stuff get in the way and they're not necessary if you hold the weapon properly and it's designed well. They get caught on stuff, all of these things. But, you know, for me, a double-edged dagger wouldn't be a direct action, you know, door kicking type of knife. It'd be a different type of knife for a different type of tasking. It's like people say, well, what's the best knife steel? And I go, well, there isn't a best knife. What are you going to do with the knife? If it's going to war, I'm not concerned with edge holding. I'm concerned with toughness, right? If the shape is proper, you'll still punch it down to the handle, even if you couldn't cut yourself with it. But if it breaks, well, as they say in Ireland, you're fucked. I grew up with the Irish. Now, if I'm doing it something else, maybe like I heard Geo flipping a particular knife there. I recognize the sound.
Well, yeah, oh, that I'll do something else, man.
Really well.
You're correct. Yeah, you're correct.
So that knife holds an edge really well. In fact, one of my top students skinned out two aurochs, which are an African antelope about the size of a big mule deer, and skinned out two aurochs with it, with just having to touch it up a little in between. And it was interesting because one of his buddies there was a former DevGru guy. When they pull the folder out, he goes, "What are you going to do with that?" They had to sharpen their knife four times on the one that they did. J. Roll only had to sharpen, just basically touch it up in between, because M390 steel holds an edge really, really well. It's one of the new super steels. Now, I wouldn't put that on a knife going to war, right? Because everything is a compromise in this universe. It's one of the things we learn from observation and everything. If it's really, really high edge holding, it's going to be more brittle. That's what you get. That's just how it works. And so you're taking and designing, you know, the steel and the shape to the task at hand. Same with the handles. We're not dueling with people with knives like that. They shouldn't even see it if you're trained. If I'm training you, they shouldn't see the knife before it actually feel it before they see it. And you have to spend time with that as well. And unfortunately, guys sometimes spend a lot more time with one than the other. But most of the time they do, because the shooting is more important most of the time. But when it's not, you want to have spent enough time to understand that other way of application as well. I want a handle where I can hold the knife however I want, point out, point back, edge up, edge down. You know, I want to be able to push on the back of it, maybe even with my body. So I don't want spikes and stuff off the back end of the handle. You know, I could be up close and we could be engaged. Maybe the only thing I can do is push my chest into the back of the knife to make it penetrate, or something like that. Or maybe hit the back of the knife with my hand in order to overcome the fact that the guy's grabbing it. We're in a moment here and I need a little bit of something to push that blade through what I want to get it through. You have to think about all the variables instead of, I like to fight with it this way, or I like to fight. It doesn't matter what I like, right? It's not about me.
So it's about the situation.
It's about the situation and what solution is being presented by the problem. And you can see in this last 19 years, without defining the problem accurately, what are we doing with all of this thing over 19 years? Where's the strategy? I can't see a strategy, and my study is actually fundamentally the study of strategy. I don't see a strategy in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria. I see a lot of reactions, and I see some things people want to accomplish. But the lack of understanding of the cultures and all of the vast things there, that people don't understand how complicated those areas are in every way, shape, and form. They're ethnically complicated, they're religious complication. There's you know, linguistic complication. There's everything happening in these regions. And without understanding that, you can't just tread in there and think you're going to, you know, apply solutions blanket, which obviously hasn't worked, right? I mean, we can look at that scoreboard.
Yeah.
You know, Sensei, the last time, I mean, you already know that I carry an Ozuraku Zukuri folder, but I also have, you know, the fixed prime blade as well. Same blade, same length, 3.5 inches. My son was...
Three and a half or four and a half, which one?
3.5.
Okay, all right.
And my son was here with me, and, you know, I had a parcel delivered that day, you know, typical hefty plastic with bubble lining on the inside. And he started tugging at it, and I pulled out the Zukuri, flipped it open, and turned it around and said, "Here, use this." And so he whipped the thing, the whole top of it off, and then he just stood there, and he looked at me, and he said, "Dad, I didn't feel a thing." And I thought that was a pretty good testament to how efficient these blades are, man.
Excellent.
Yes.
So tell us, you have boys and girls.
Yeah, I have girls, and my
have a granddaughter.
Daughter carries, she carries one of your blades as well.
I mean, and when you think about it, in my paradigm, knife is not the best personal defense tool. However, they do lots of things. I've had to cut a person out of a seatbelt when they're, you know, when their vehicle overturned.
Yeah.
Cut and open a pants leg up to say, what happened here? Or do you need a tourniquet? Can we do it with pressure? Do I need to open a package, right? It's a fundamental tool of human beings that goes so far back in history, we can't even look that far back, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I remember when I was like 6 and my grandpa looks at me and he goes, "Boy, a man needs a knife."
Yeah.
Thinking about self-defense. And in those days, we had folders, you know, nothing locked, right? We just had,
yeah, that's right.
You know, we had just these little pocket folders and jackknives, we called them. One of the things we used to practice when I got a little bit older was, since you have a knife that's going to close on your hand, you'd put your finger on the blade right in front of, you know, when it opened, and then your thumb there, and you practice only moving a particular way with the knife so it wouldn't fold back on your hand. Oh, man, I survived some stupidity in my life. I'm not sure why.
I fear that I insulted you with my story about opening the parcel.
Oh, no, not at all. That's what knives are used for, whatever. Opening a parcel, I use them to open parcels, right? Niet problem, not a problem. I use them to open parcels. Whatever, I mean, it's a tool. Some get more specific, and with some of my knives, there's no compromise for their intended purpose, but that doesn't mean they can't be used for other things.
I'm just really particular about the kind of utility, you know, function that I'll use this knife for. I mean, a lot of other knives I carry, I'm trying to twist screws off with them, you know, and I know I'm going to ruin
it. That I don't recommend.
But with this,
that's why God made screwdrivers.
Yeah, this is a different story with this knife. I'm real picky about what I'll do with it.
Right, right. Well, again, we have to understand what tool we use and how and why.
Perfect.
James, thank you very much for joining us for this episode of Sawfrick Radio, as well as George, Gio.
My pleasure, man. This was unbelievable. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, thank you, guys. And so, remembering what Atiputi Greek I can remember, Eferistos Tavros.
Parakalo, parakalo.
I'm jealous.
Thank you.
Well, you speak way more languages than I do, Gio, so...
Yeah.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio. New episodes up every Wednesday and Friday. Follow the show on Instagram and Twitter at Soft Rep Radio.